Hey, hello, and welcome to Rhymes Against Humanity, number 12. I know in the beginning of this I say it's number 10, but it's actually number 12 of the interview with Brenda Kahn. I was really lucky to get to talk to Brenda. We hadn't spoken in a while, and I actually went up to her her beautiful home, and it was my first remote situation. And then, of course, I left my fancy schmancy microphone, and I had to have somebody swing by and pick it up. It became a whole thing. Anyway, totally jazzed to have Brenda play a few songs, and it was good to reconnect with an old friend. And on top of that, she also gave me some super insight into a bunch of pieces of the antifolk puzzle, of the history of antifolk puzzle, including some stuff I had never known about a particular venue that I had never even heard of. That tells what an antifolk incompletist I am as an historian. Anyway, we'll get right to it. It is, as we are recording now, the 10th, as I'm recording this now, it's the 10th. So as you know, Rhymes Against Humanity coming out to you on the 10th, 20th, and 30th of every month, with no particular decision yet made about what we're going to do about the end of February. So I have some more cool guests coming up, but possibly none so cool as the president of Through Being Cool Records herself. Sit back and enjoy my interview with Brenda freaking Kahn, one of my idols and one of my friends, and hopefully you will enjoy the whole thing. All right, rock it. Ooh, this place is so nice. Thank you. Welcome to Rhymes Against Humanity, number 010. Next one will be its bar mitzvah. But this is how we are ending its childhood. We are ending its childhood with, actually, I'm not a fanboy for most people. There are there's a small list of people. And at the head of that list, and I'm trying to keep my cool because she's just a friend of mine now. But this is Brenda Kahn. This is the first rock star that I made my friend. There, she's giving me the devil horns. So it's a pleasure to be up here. She let me come up to her lovely home in, are we in the Poconos? Is this? No, we're not. We're just in Allentown.
Lehigh Valley.
Okay. So I came up here and she allowed me to speak to her during a brief quiet moment before the husband and the children, and then she's running away. But very shortly we're gonna. Oh yes, agua. So we're going to have a nice talk with Brenda Kahn, who, if you don't know, is an amazing songwriter and some would say a seminal antifolk figure. Seminal, she says.
Definitely.
So here, I'm handing her back her very nice guitar, and we are going to keep on chatting with my good friend, Brenda. How are you, Brenda?
I am well.
Good.
Thanks.
Very good.
Really glad to be here.
Well, in your own home.
In my home.
But
where I live.
We got our schedules together, you and I. It's been a genuine clusterfuck just finding an hour and a half, and actually.
It's been pretty hard.
Yeah, so with the crowning achievement being we finally agreed on a day, and I said, how about Thursday the 23rd? Well, there is no Thursday the 23rd. So you were expecting me tomorrow, I was expecting today, so we split the difference.
That's right.
So anyway, we are here with Brenda Kahn, who is what. I'm gonna tell my origin story.
Okay.
This is how I became aware of Brenda Kahn. I believe it was 1992. I can't be sure, but
likely.
But 1992, WXPN had on Dylan's birthday, May 24th. They played 24 hours of Dylan. So they play all his songs, and then every once in a while they did an hour of new Dylans. And so they're playing all the new Dylans, and they're playing some Bruce, and they're playing John Prine, and whoever else they're playing. And then there's this female voice rattling off words quicker than I can catch him. And I'm like, who is this? This is amazing.
Wow, I was in the new Dylan category. I love it.
Because Michaela Majoon, the DJ, said, a female new Dylan? Sure, why not? And I said, sure, why not? And then I went home, and this was before the internet, pretty much, or maybe 1990, before I had.
It was just rolling out.
Right.
Yeah.
So I went to a record store and I said, have you ever heard of Brenda Kahn? Now, were you were on Sony Work at that time, or Sony Chaos? Which one?
Chaos. Yeah.
Okay. And that was 92. You were on the label at that point. Okay. So
92. I was signed in. I was signed in 92, the end of 92. So I did have an album. Goldfish came out 2 years before that.
Okay, now that was never was never on Sony, right?
I don't know what she was playing, but no, it wasn't.
It was I Don't Sleep. She was playing your big major
album.
Yeah,
okay, yeah. So,
from when did Epiphany in Brooklyn come out?
When did it come out? I don't know. I feel like
this is how big a rock star I'm sitting with.
I was 90. 92, 93.
Okay. So it was a new release. That's why it was in XPN's offices. It was right around.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, that makes sense then. So
I actually recorded I Don't Sleep and one other song in Minneapolis, and that's what was on this 7-inch single that was released a year before that. And then that's what got me signed to Columbia.
Okay.
And then when David Kahn went to produce the album, he didn't want to change those songs. So I actually produced that song and it went on as is.
Okay.
To the major label.
So the version of I Don't Sleep that's on Epiphany in Brooklyn is the version you recorded in Minneapolis?
Yeah, at Gark Studios, like just me and...
Gark, G-A-R-K?
G-A-R-K, yeah.
Nice. So, okay.
Which I don't know if it exists. It was, you know, this guy's basement.
So let's start. Now, where did you grow up?
I grew up in New Jersey.
Okay.
Central Jersey.
Okay. What town?
East Windsor.
Okay.
Woo!
Represent.
Heights Down High School, yo.
That's right.
And actually, Heights Down High School, while not a sort of fancy school, just kind of a public school, had a very exceptional arts program. And
okay.
They had an incredible music department and theater department, and this guy... John Bates, who ran a kind of singer-songwriter showcase thing where he would book acts into the school, kind of national folk acts.
Yeah, I think I went to the school and saw a show there at some point.
He had really good people come sometimes. So it was a neat place for someone who was interested in that kind of thing. And it's really kind of funny for me because it's sort of come full circle because my 10-year-old son is going to be in his first show of Oliver in November. And it's just wild to
see
that reflection way in the distance.
What's he playing in Oliver?
Oh, he's in the chorus.
Nice.
But it's his first ever anything, you know. And I was in the chorus in Oliver.
All right.
Ninth grade. So
nice.
It's pretty funny.
All right. So you're in Hightstown, New Jersey. It always interests me how it becomes I understand completely why guys pick up guitars.
Right.
what inspired you?
Well, you know what? My sister is 2.5 years older than me, and she started playing guitar, I think she was 13, maybe 14. So I was, you know, 11-ish. And I was like, I want to play guitar too, you know. So after playing violin and piano and horseback riding and whatever, my parents were like, yeah, whatever, okay. Eventually got me this like little Best Buy guitar, and you know, I was immediately like clear that was the thing I was gonna do.
Okay.
It wasn't like you know, I was just like, what, this exists and I haven't had one until now? Like
an acoustic?
A little acoustic. I mean, this thing was like
little toy.
Yeah, it was a toy.
Okay.
And you know, the glue was coming off the headstock, so it was starting to... And I went to my parents about, I don't know, 3 weeks after I got it and said, I need a better guitar. As a parent,
you sound
now,
like a Jewish girl from New Jersey.
Yeah, I was not a princess, but I was like, I need a better one of these.
Yeah.
I mean, well, whatever. Anyway, but my parents were like, yeah, no, that's not going to happen. But they were like, well, listen, if you play this for a year, you know, we'll get you a better one. It's like, not a problem.
Okay.
Just completely clear. And I did. And I wrote tons of songs. And I would go to guitar lessons, not do the assignment, go home, take the chords that they taught me and make my own song.
Sweet.
And that's just what I always did. It wasn't until... years and years and years later, when I was teaching guitar, that I actually figured out the real rules of how to play it.
Are there chords that you play completely wrong now? Because
so much. I mean, it was more that I really didn't know the pentatonic scales. I didn't really know, I didn't really know my way around the guitar. It was always this tool for me to write songs.
So, did you fall in love with the guitar before you fell in love? Like, did you have songwriting idols? Were you listening to stuff on the radio at the time, or was it all about you making music?
Oh yeah, no. I had idols. I mean, like, I felt like I was kind of bizarrely trapped in New Jersey in this weird world where, you know, So just like finding the guitar, I was like, there's this other place that I'm supposed to be, and I would access that through, you know, Lou Reed and Elvis Costello and Laurie Anderson and the Talking Heads, and they were my window to the world.
Okay.
Because I felt completely isolated in New Jersey, and also somewhat unhappy because, you know, I grew up with a pretty serious anxiety disorder. I don't know if I ever really talked about it, but I had OCD since I was a kid. So I was like, just felt like a freak, you know?
Like OCD, you had to count the tiles?
That kind of thing, but it was more like, you know, I didn't like certain things in certain places. I didn't like this, I didn't like that. Very kind of, and at that time, like, people didn't say OCD. They were like, ah, she'll grow out of it. You know, it wasn't until I was like in my 20s, I was watching some TV show and I was just like, wait, that's what I have. Like, that's my thing. You know, I didn't know other people. I just thought they'd cart me off to a loony bin at some point if they really knew how crazy I was in my head. And at that point in my 20s, like, I went to this, you went through therapy. I had a really great therapist and, you know, it's like not a huge factor in my life any longer, but
sweet.
It was a huge factor in my life when I was a kid. So there I was, like, trapped in crazy and trapped in New Jersey at the same time. And this was like my big way out.
Okay.
So it was amazing for me. So that's kind of where.
Do you ever revisit any of those preteen songs? Like, I mean, obviously not on stage, but.
No. And I would love to hear them. And I think my mom might have a cassette tape. I know in high school, I went somewhere to a recording studio and recorded some songs.
Okay.
I was really into it. I took singing lessons. And I was also like a real theater person. I was in every play. I was the lead in the school musical.
What musical?
My Fair Lady.
So you were Liza Doolittle?
All I want is a room somewhere.
I used to love that play because I couldn't sing as a child, and some say today. And so I loved Rex Harrison. I was like, he found a loophole.
Yeah, totally. So funny. It was, yeah. So I was completely into it. And then, but always knew that I wasn't going to be a theater major. And then when I left high school, everyone thought I was going to be in theater. I was like, no, I'm going to be a singer-songwriter. Like, I'm going to be like, you know, these people that I was, you know, idolizing. I want to be like the Laurie Anderson or what, like the Pretenders. She was a huge hero for me.
So do you remember your first show or the first concert you went to that made that huge impact on you? It was like, whoa, look at them. I want to do that.
I mean, there were a lot.
Okay.
I mean, I did have this like very turning point kind of experience seeing The Clash when I was 16 in Asbury Park, New Jersey. And I went with a bunch of friends and
The Saint or the Stone Pony? No,
it was that one that was sort of outside.
Oh,
I forget what it's called.
I don't know that one, but okay.
I actually don't even remember. But we were, it was like a crush of humanity. And it was so hot. And at the end of the concert, I actually passed out. Had to be like pulled out of the crowd. And it was terrifying. But I think it was so powerful. And I remember just coming home and knowing I couldn't tell my parents like what had actually happened. And I remember I was wearing like a pink mini, like a polka dotted mini skirt, like a white and black polka dotted mini skirt. And like, it was just so funny, like that time.
So this is mid 80s.
Yeah.
So you had the claw up top?
No. No, I had a asymmetrical.
Oh, the asymmetrical.
Yeah, like half shaved.
Oh,
a little bit.
The back. Yeah, I know exactly that one.
And then this one. But my hair was curly, so it never worked for me. No. Like, it was just totally wrong. And my friends were the only two, like, punk rock kids in the school.
Right.
Who got, like, food chucked at them at lunchtime. And
hard row.
It just stinks being in high school, right?
Like, there's, I mean, no,
it's
good
great
way, yeah.
And it's awful. And it's just, wow.
Well, now you get to live it twice more now with your children. You That's get to watch right. them suffer.
I know.
Well, they're about to get into middle school soon.
Yeah, well, my older son is in a charter school that goes 5th through 8th grade, so he actually is in middle school.
He's the youngest kid in middle school?
Yes. Oh. And he's already kind of, you know, clicky, and these kids don't like me, and these kids are... And he's got it all wired. He's like, well, there's the jocks and the geeks and the thing and the thing. It was actually a lot worse even at the regular public school, but then there's an arts charter school, and he's studying. He loves to draw, so he's got
okay.
his focus as art. And I feel like it's better there because it's broken up into, like, dance and art, music, and theater, and ice skating.
That's okay. a thing? Okay, ice sure.
skating. Yeah. And
man, you're out in the suburbs ice skating.
We're in like Pennsylvania.
Yes.
So I feel like it's actually a little better because the kids are all kind of creative and geeky.
Oh, nice.
In a way, you know, so even if they're different from one another, they've all got this common.
And so it's an arts-based middle school.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah. I think it's because there's a pretty well-established arts-based high school. And
so you think he'll matriculate there to the high school?
I have no idea.
Okay.
He's such a bright light on so many different planes.
Nice.
I don't know what he'll end up doing.
Well, let's do this now. Why don't you hit me with a song? Absolutely. We had an intense negotiation. Like about because I'm such a fan, I wanted to hear songs from
so
you know like 100 years ago.
Old or new?
You know what? Whatever you want. I'm not gonna force you to play. Whatever you feel like playing right friggin' now.
Okay. Well, let's start new,
okay.
And then we'll work our way backwards.
Sure.
Backwards in time.
There we go.
I actually can do
like
that.
Like Memento.
I can travel backwards in time. All right. Well, this is called Salome, and it's not recorded. It's something I've been working on, so work in progress.
All right.
Salome rides horseback through pink heather at daybreak with a broadsword swagger, feet wrapped in leather, crossing a midnight train, an oriental desert, just an occidental traveler on a wayward adventure. And here's my message out to you. There's a hole in the universe we are falling through, so set your intention to the best and shoot your arrows true. Cold and crumpled soldier writing letters to his lover, who was lost and undercover in a whirlwind of pleasure. Madonna, with her sexy list falls short, she ties her Mexican bandanas to broken truck antennas again. Here's my message out to you. There's a hole in the universe we are falling through, so set your intention to the best and shoot your arrows true. To you, there's a hole in the universe we are falling through, so set your intention to the best, shoot your arrows true. Shoot your arrows true. Shoot your arrows true. Ooh, 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 ooh.
Very nice. And how old is that?
I wrote it like last year.
Okay,
but
so we'll call that new for guys our age.
Oh yeah, that's new.
Now, so what do you think? What do you think you write a year?
Now?
Yeah, now.
A couple songs.
Okay. Yeah. And what in your prime when you were?
Well, when I moved to New York to go to college at NYU.
Okay.
I connected with that whole scene, the sort of anti-folk scene, and the.
Is that where you met Latch?
That's where I met Latch.
Okay, so wait, so you graduate from Hightstown High.
Yeah.
And then and then you're going to go to NYU and study theater or no, what?
Political science.
Oh, right, that's right. You're a poli-sci major.
Actually, journalism. That was my first. I wanted to write. I always wanted to write. That's what I always did. And so I thought journalism, right? And then a couple semesters into journalism, I was just like, God, you know, this isn't really what I want to write. Like, I'm sort of, you know, I would be learning things like, okay, what's the most important thing to put in the lead? Is it like, you know, the 18th century house burned down, the baby who died in the fire, the neighborhood house that caught fire next door, and, you know, now they're homeless. And I'd be like, well, I think it would be like the color of the bricks as the like fire was burning and the, you know, the sound of the, you know, it just, I could tell, you know, it wasn't quite. And I felt like I'm going to learn this craft of writing, but what am I going to write about? Like, I feel like I'm going to college and not learning anything.
Okay.
So I switched to political science because I felt like that would give me some perspective. And I love to travel, and I love, so it was really an international relations major.
So you were living in the dorms at NYU?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
For the first couple of years.
Okay, and then, so you go down to the, you go down to the open mic, was
this is how it goes. So okay. I'm hanging out in Washington Square Park.
Oh, nice, I'm glad.
And Roger Manning.
Oh, Roger.
Rocking out on his guitar.
Okay.
And I was like, oh, yeah, that's cool, you know, and I started talking to him and got to be friends with him and later went out with him. But he was my introduction to Latch's scene and also ABC No Rio, which was a sort of parallel scene. That had crossover, but not completely.
I have to plead complete embarrassing ignorance to that.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And I consider myself an anti-folk historian.
Really? Because you know what? ABC No Rio, in many ways, was way more of an influence and a profound sort of experience for me.
Go on.
It was on Rivington Street. The reason they called it ABC No Rio was because it was an old notary republic, and the letters had mostly fallen off the window, but the ones left were ABC No Rio, Notario Republica. So it was this blank, just raw space, and there was like a bathroom with a curtain, you know, there was just nothing
nice
there. And every Sunday, Matthew Courtney would do what he called the wide open cabaret or the wide open mic, and it was, you know, like you had just kind of similar, like two songs, 8 minutes sort of
right
thing. But the cast of characters on that stage was just amazing. I mean, they were fascinating people, and it was a cross-section of artists, poets, and really like crazy neighborhood people.
Okay.
Who would show up and just rant. And, you know,
and was there a hat to be passed or not at all?
There was no hat to be passed. It was, and Roger used to call it church because it was Sunday, and people would just like come, you know, and it was these people, Tommaso and John Hall from
King Missile
was there pretty much every week. and Callie Hirsch and Patty Lee, who were good friends of mine. Callie and I are writing a children's book together right
Sweet.
Now. Yeah, and she was a photographer and took lots of pictures, and
So it was a real vibrant scene.
It was really vibrant, and it was like cutting edge of, you know, it was while performance art was coming into mainstream, and
before it became eye rolly.
Right, yeah. But I mean, people were like, I remember one Halloween, you know, these people did this little skit where they had a bunch of pumpkins and you had 8 minutes, right? So they ran out on stage with like six pumpkins, cut them open really super fast, like started pulling out all the seeds and just like putting them all over each other. And like the whole time they're saying these like poetry, like words. And like, I mean, it sounds goofy now, but at the time we were like, what's going to happen next? You know, you don't know what anyone's going to do on any given time. So, but anyway, to answer your question, I wrote my songs every week for that open mic every Sunday. And I wanted something new every week, and everybody did. We were all like, okay, what am I going to do next week?
So these were, these songs ended up on Goldfish?
Yes, a lot of them did.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's so back in like in the late 80s, in that scene, it would not be uncommon for you to walk away from a year with 30 some songs.
Oh yeah. I mean, I have over 100 songs published on all my albums. Sorry, I'm putting my hand over my mouth. And a lot of them were just like from this kind of workshop environment
Great.
It was awesome.
I never heard of that. Do you know how it flamed out? How did it end? Or
Matthew Courtney, well, there was sort of this core few people who kind of kept it going. And the main thing was Matthew. And then there was this guy, Winchester Chimes, who you probably know from the song.
Yeah.
What year was it? I think it was 89 or 9. Yeah, it must have been 89 or 88. Got AIDS and died of AIDS. And I think that was a very big turning point for Matthew. It was really sad when he died. And then a couple years after that, maybe he stopped doing it. I don't know. But somehow, if Matthew didn't do it, it just didn't.
Yeah,
it needed him. He was the glue for that particular
Do you know where he's at now?
Place. I think he's still in New York. They actually did a reunion recently, like maybe 2 or 3 years ago, and a lot of people came. It was.
They just had a Fort reunion. I think Steve Espinola was.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was. Was running. I couldn't make it, but. All right, so there's that scene.
So there's that scene, and then Sophie's Bar was on Avenue B, and, what was it? Fifth between A and B.
Okay.
And that's where the Fort was.
Okay.
Until it moved over to Sidewalk.
To Sidewalk, okay.
So I was living, you know, right around Washington Square, and I would, you know, don my black trench coat and my humongous guitar case.
Did you smoke cloves?
No, I wasn't a smoker because I tried to smoke and then it made my voice start to like sound bad. So I was like, I'll have to find another way to kill myself. I'll date drug addicts.
There you go.
That's what I'll do. probably should have stuck to smoking. That would have been better. But so I'd sort of like pick up my guitar and haul it, you know.
What were you playing then?
I had, I had the guitar that after I played for a year,
right.
I went to my dad and my mom and I said, okay, we had a deal. It's a year.
All right.
I've been like tracking it. And and they said, okay. And my dad took me to New York City to Matt Umanov and bought me this. The company's called Lees, L-Y-S.
I don't
know if they're still making guitars, but it was a Canadian
nice.
Guitar. It was beautiful.
Solid top, spruce and mahogany?
Something, not mahogany. I think maybe
rose?
Spruce. No.
Spruce top, and remember what the sides were?
I think it was maple.
Oh, very nice.
Blonde.
Oh, nice blonde guitar. Blondie. Blonde guitar for a black-haired girl.
That's right. And I played that forever, well, for a really long time. And then one day I was in my apartment in Brooklyn, and it was leaning up against a kitchen table, and it just fell, and the dovetail smashed. The whole thing was destroyed in 1 second. But the good news was I bought a different, better guitar.
Nice.
And, you know, so.
Have you ever heard a Loud Wainwright song, Red Guitar?
I don't know that one.
It's about how he gets drunk and burns his guitar.
Ouch, that's a bad thing to wake up to.
Yeah, yeah, it's actually a very clever little song on one of his records. I forget which one. All right, so now you're tell me how you meet Latch.
Oh, so right, so I was gonna say, I'd be sort of like trekking over to the East Side to, well, Latch in the meantime, because we were still, Folk City was still happening for
right,
a year when I was at NYU, and then it closed
down. Did you gain traction over in the West Village? Did they like you?
Well, and then the other, what's the other one? Oh, that's awful.
Was it Cafe Wa or the Gaslight?
No, the on Bleecker Street.
You're the New York kid. Jack Hardy's.
You know all of them.
Yeah, right. I just don't, from your songs.
Okay, I'll think of it as soon as the interview's over.
Yeah, right.
But, so there was another place, but anyway, Latch got kicked out of there. I can't remember why now.
Were you there when he got kicked out?
No, okay. I wasn't there. But that was the impetus for him to start his own thing on the East Side.
Right.
And he was like, all right, you're on the West Side. I'm going to start my own anti-folk.
Yeah, because it was the West Village Folk Festival. And so he said, according to, this is the way he tells his story, is if they're going to have a folk festival that I'm not in, I'll have an anti-folk festival.
Right.
And he claims that's how the name got started.
That is.
Now, okay.
That
now, other people have,
what
have
I remember.
You know, debated that. I forget.
Oh, yeah?
I forget whether it was, somebody said, someone else claimed, you know, how that always goes or what, nobody knows. But I'm willing to give it to Latch. So.
Oh, yeah. I totally think it was Latch's. It was Latch's thing.
Okay.
I don't know who, I don't know. Whatever.
Yeah, so. So he goes over to and then he starts at his sidewalk at
Sophie's Bar. Yeah. So then every Tuesday at Sophie's Bar, we'd be like, you know, push the pool table over right under the light that the pool table, you know, that was above the pool table.
I've never been to Sophie's, but okay.
And I remember my first time ever going there. I was 18. I was terrified. And I was finger picking. What was it? I don't remember the song. It was a song called Buildings. And it was this really quiet. I mean, this is a loud, smoky New York bar.
Right.
And there's like a lot of seasoned performers. I'm this like 18-year-old girl from New Jersey. I'm not even allowed to be in the bar because they just changed the... Oh, no, I think it was grandfathered in, whatever.
Oh, you got grandfathered in.
I think so, yeah.
See, you're like 1 year older than me and I didn't make the cut.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Right, that's right. But, so I'm up there singing about this quiet. And something happened to me that has continued to happen to me for my entire career, which is that the audience fell silent, which I have never quite understood what quality it is about the way that I perform that gets people's attention. I don't...
There's some people have an intangible magnetism.
Well, thank you very much.
No, I mean, you clearly have it. I mean,
I don't know what that is, but it has always been a little bit of a shock to me. You know, like where I'm like, how am I ever going to compete in this room? You know, and it was like, boom, everyone was staring at me. My fingers were shaking. I was completely terrified. But I remember Latch came up to me afterwards and said, hey, you know, that was really good. Do you want to come play here sometime? And that was my first gig.
Yes.
So it was pretty awesome.
He always says that whenever I talk about Brenda. He's like, I gave her first gig.
That's right. He absolutely did. And it was huge for me. I mean, it was just like this, you know.
Yeah.
Dream come true. Gig in New York City.
Hell yeah.
Isn't that amazing?
I remember when Latch gave me a gig.
Yeah, right.
It was amazing.
So the fort was really important to me as well. It wasn't like, you know, less or more, but I would say for ABC, the ABC No Rio scene, it was so like motivating. Like you just wanted to have something new. At the fort, you wanted to have something good.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was a little bit like, even if your song wasn't finished, you'd do it at No Rio. But at the fort, you wanted to perform.
It's very funny because I used to play at a place called John and Peter's.
Yeah, and
that's the same thing because I would go up there every week. I'd want something new.
Yeah.
And then when I went to New York, like, you know, I was making a pilgrimage to Mecca, and I had to come hard with the A material.
Right. Yeah. You really felt like, you know, you had to be, you know, on top of your game. And I think that's kind of, you know, what I didn't realize was happening the whole time I was in college and, you know, trekking over to the Lower East Side every week. I was really being, you know, it was like a second college, you know. It was songwriter college that I was going
right.
to, but I didn't know it until I moved right after school. I put out my first album on Community 3 Records. And
Goldfish
then,
Don't Talk Back. If anybody finds a copy of that, spend whatever it costs. I freaking love that record.
Or just email me and I'll...
Or that, Brenda will give you a copy.
I'll send it to you for $10.
There you go. That's the way to get it.
Yeah. Because, you know, I think it does cost more. Anyway, but so I moved to Minneapolis and I got up on stage and was like a consummate professional because I'd been struggling against the New York audience.
So why'd you go to Minneapolis?
I followed a guy.
Nice. Yes, I will leave New York City for Minneapolis.
It was
not even St. Paul.
It was all about the tragic relationship for me at that time. I mean, I actually broke up with a guy in New York that I was really, really close to, and it was kind of a crazy experience. And then he broke up with me.
There's some story about one of you and Rogers, something about a bucket of a pitcher of beer being poured on heads.
Oh my. Well, that's not even the guy I met.
Okay.
That was like before that. That was when I was in school, and you know, Roger was an amazing person to me. I was, you know, I mean, he's like 10 years older than me. So when I was like 20, he just seemed like he had all the answers and...
With all the wisdom of a 30-year-old.
You know what I mean?
Yes, I do.
But he had traveled in Europe a lot. I really wanted to do that. You know, it was like really interesting to me. And, you know, it's funny, like when I look back, like I wrote that song, She's in Love, you know, with the man that she always wanted to be. I think that was so true about me. Not everything is autobiographical in my songs, but...
Is that the song where you say frustration?
I think so.
I love that song.
Oh, no, that's not it.
Is that Mint Juleps? Which one is it? I don't know.
Wait, it's...
Like I said, I listen to all on cassettes. I don't know which or
no,
which.
No, it's... Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is. But I think, like, you know, this person can do this. Like, I want to be like that, you know? And I would just sort of, like, you know, kind of want to be as close to that as I could. And I think Well, anyway, so when Roger and I broke up, it was just wasn't a good breakup. It was kind of nasty and mean. And,
okay.
And
you guys talk at all, or is that over? Is it you?
Oh yeah, no, totally.
Oh good.
Now.
Oh great.
Yeah.
Good. I'm glad to hear that.
Oh yeah.
I mean, yeah, it's all that's under the
bridge. I'm not a grudge holder, but you know, he did something that was not nice to do in a relationship, and I was very angry about that, and then he didn't think that was a good enough reason to break up, and I did. And so later, I was in England for a year. I spent a year at the London School of Economics.
Really?
Yes, I did.
Doing what?
Studying political science.
That's awesome.
From the best people in the world.
Yeah.
It was awesome. And then when I came back... You know, I sort of was like, all right, we're not together, but, you know, I belong here too. And he didn't feel that way. So it was.
Oh.
He did a couple things that he probably regrets.
Oh,
I would imagine.
Turf wars. Yeah. Yeah.
So,
I used to hate that feeling. I mean, you'd have to go into a place and put your smile on because the other person's going to be there.
Yeah. No, it was very, you know, it was a little tense.
Well, good. I'm glad it's all water under the bridge.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But we would write nasty songs and things about each other.
Yeah, that's classic.
Classic.
Yeah. So now, what did you do when you were out in Minneapolis? What did you work?
So in Minneapolis, yeah. So when I so so I got this record deal with Community 3 Records.
Okay, which then, was, what was exactly was that, Community 3?
Albert Garzon, who's a pretty amazing guy and a really incredible, you know, music person, put together this label and signed a bunch of really, really, really good artists. And but it was a little indie label. It was just him. And, you know, he would do a certain amount of promotion, whatever he could. And Goldfish Don't Talk Back charted on CMJ pretty high.
Right.
So it was getting played at all the college radio stations. And
was Gold, do you remember, was Goldfish Don't Talk Back, was that the single?
What were they playing? I don't know. I think, yeah, probably mostly, oh, no. Eggs on Drugs.
Eggs on Drugs, of course.
Yeah.
of course. Yeah.
I forgot.
That's a pretty good song,
I forgot
too.
For a minute. That's so funny. Well, yeah, so for people who don't know or don't remember, they had that great ad when in the early 90s with the anti-drug campaign, and they had a frying pan and an egg, and they'd say, this is your brain. And then they'd pan down to the frying pan, this is drugs. And then they'd crack the egg on the frying pan and say, this is your brain on drugs.
It's very potent.
So I wrote Eggs on Drugs, which is...
How about the chorus? Can you give me the chorus of that? Just strum
the
that
chorus?
For me. Yeah, you can do that.
This is an egg. This is drugs. This is an egg on drugs.
It's a much more brilliant song than that, but it's
my
pretty
favorite,
good.
My favorite part was, I get insulted every time that I turn on my TV, told that freedom of choice is a variety of 50 kinds of breakfast cereal with different names whose ingredients all read exactly the same. How did this country get so insane? Girls try so hard to conform, they'll make themselves puke to belong, and then 3 years later they have false tips sewn on. They thought the First Amendment meant you didn't have to agree. Well, from where I stand, it looks like shit to me. I can't curse on the radio. I'm not even allowed to curse in my house.
You can curse on my podcast.
No, go my crazy. Children will.
All right. Do you have a swear jar?
We do.
Oh,
we
nice.
Have a swear jar.
I'll leave about $5 in when I go.
Yeah. And now I'm going to have to put money in. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
You just cost me.
You're the one that wrote the brilliant song.
So, Eggs on Drugs, right. That was the big song. And so, anyway, I wanted to tour. And being in New York, I was working at the Environmental Defense Fund, which, had I stayed, probably would have been a good idea. But instead, I had a music career. So I
You could have been Al Gore's mistress.
I could have been. Ew. Not. I met the person who did the videos for Community 3 Records.
Okay.
Was Phil Harder, and he is an absolutely amazing videographer and filmmaker. So you should definitely look him up. He has some really neat, inventive kinds of
cool
things going on. And he made music videos back then, and I just loved his energy, and he was talking about Minneapolis, and I was like, you know what? Sounds like a great town.
How old
I want
Phil?
A tour. He's like my age.
Okay.
You know, maybe a couple years older or something.
Okay.
But he had this band in Minneapolis, and in he lived in the same I'm gonna forget their name. The same building. They called it the Big Trouble House, and his band was called Big Trouble House. As the drummer from that awesome girl punk band. Can't remember who they
awesome
are.
Awesome girl punk band.
Anyway,
okay.
You're not gonna remember.
No.
No, they were like Minneapolis. Like they played with like Nirvana and some people like that. But
okay,
I'll remember it right after the interview. See,
okay,
I didn't know
enough.
I was going to be quizzed on my entire
notes.
Life. Anyway, it was a great, great, great music scene.
Did
there.
You meet the Purple
I mean,
guy?
Amazing. No, but I did play there
okay.
at his place, and and actually did this gig there with Jackson Browne, of all people, who whose people took tape off my guitar case to use for a mic or something. And I was like,
without permission?
Yeah. And I was like, really, guys? Like, it's so funny, like, all these things that, you know, like, connect you to people in the music world. Anyway, so...
By the way, that is... we've done 12 of these podcasts, and that's the second Jackson Browne anecdote that we've come across.
It?
Just by accident, yeah.
Really?
So, he's going to become the patron saint.
That's right. Well, I had no actual truck with Jackson Browne, but the folks who did that. And that was fun. And I got to be good friends with the guys from Soul Asylum. And I had a great, great, great experience there. I mean, that town really just took me in a way that I didn't even know.
So how long were you there?
I was about a little over a year.
Okay. And that's where you recorded?
That's where I recorded I Don't Sleep.
Okay.
And the Dollar Bill Blues.
You played that for me once.
Yeah?
Yeah. Somehow that's a memory for me.
Isn't that the one that's like... Did I write that? I don't remember. Anyway.
Okay.
And I think there's another song. Oh, yeah, Mint Juleps and Needles is the other song that's on that. And I had such a good experience there. Like, my rent was cheap, and I toured and toured the entire time that I lived there.
So how far out did you get?
I went all the way, like, from there. I don't think I did a West Coast tour when I lived there, but I did East Coast tours.
Okay.
So I would go from basically the middle of the country.
Down to Chicago and then over?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then, but I also, the Goldfish album did incredibly well at this radio station in Tallahassee, Florida.
Okay.
So I flew down there and then would play with Tallahassee, Atlanta, and, you know, do some southern dates. So I was getting this traction with Goldfish and then touring behind that album.
Okay.
A lot. And then this one of my tours back to New York, I met Jonathan Block, who was a manager, music manager.
Okay.
And really liked me and really wanted to to manage me. And I said, listen, I do everything myself. Like, you know, are you hearing?
Yeah. Can that go off? Is you know what that is? Or, I mean, if it can be solved.
You know what? Yeah. Hold on.
All right. We are back. We have solved the, the fish were dying. The water was a fish tank issue, but we've solved the hum. You have your pick? We should play another song, and actually, it would be a great time to play I Don't Sleep, if you can. I mean, can you?
I give it a go.
All right. This is the big Brenda Khan hit. This is the song that will dog you. This is the song that will be on your epitaph.
Oh, man. Will it?
No,
think?
No. You're
on
a mom
my actual
now.
Gravestone. There's,
you've done so much more.
I don't sleep. I drink coffee and sit. Can I say a quick story about
this? Of course.
Minneapolis, it is a good time because I'm in Minneapolis, I'm touring and touring and touring, and I'm eating less and less and drinking coffee more and more, and I'm just sort of in this kind of constantly wired, going from here to there kind of state, and I'm back at my apartment in Minneapolis. I wake up one morning with this horrible pain in my stomach, and I was like, I gotta go to the bathroom. I get up, I walk towards the bathroom. I completely pass out and, you know, just kind of like smack my head on the wall. My roommate wakes up and is like, oh my God, are you okay? You know, I don't know. Like,
You moved to Minneapolis for Phil, but weren't living with Phil?
No, I mean, not like for, I kind of followed him there. You know, I just left.
Well, you guys were a thing?
Yeah, we kind of were, but we didn't live together. We were, you know, it wasn't like that serious. It wasn't like, I love you, let's get married.
I'm just moving to the town that you're moving to, but it's totally cash.
I just wanted to tour. I wanted, you know, I loved his whole lifestyle. And
cool.
I really, really liked him. You know, like, I thought he was awesome. And we really had a great time there, but I, you know, whatever, it didn't work out for whatever reasons. But
okay, so you pass out, roommate.
So I'm like in this, you know, kind of like excruciating pain. She takes me to the hospital, And they check me out, and eventually they're like, you know what? We tested your blood. You're basically fine, except you have like no potassium at all in your blood, and that's why your stomach's cramping. Like, you can't even like stop. So they like give me this IV drip of basically salt water and a little bit of vitamins.
Okay.
And I'm totally fine. And I'm like, okay.
Nutrition, baby.
I have to eat better. And I stopped drinking coffee for like 10 years. Like,
wow.
For really, really, really
long. So you would drive around the world, play this song.
And this was my song. And it was so ironic. But the good news is I just started drinking a couple years ago. And I thought, well, this is going to be a relief for all my fans.
For all my fans. The hypocrisy is over.
I don't have to continue living a lie.
All right, give us the hit.
All right, here you go. Now, I'm gonna try it on the acoustic.
Do you remember where you get the riff first, or because it's got such cool riff, the beginning riff? Did you get the riff first, or did you get the lyrics?
Oh, how I wrote it.
Yeah, how you wrote it.
Okay. When I lived in New York, I took guitar lessons with Dave Van Ronk.
I remember that. Yeah, that's right.
And
didn't he say now you're a shitty guitar player?
Yeah, no, he didn't. He just tried to talk me out of being a guitar player. He was like, "So is this something?" His gruff voice. "So is this something you think you're gonna, you know, do as a profession or just as a hobby?" And I said, "Well, no, this is what I'm gonna do." And he goes, "I'm not gonna try to talk you out of it." And I was like, "Really? Aren't you?"
Yeah, Dave's notoriously bitter.
Oh, he was so funny.
Yes.
I loved him. But he suggested just writing a lot, write a song every day kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I never was good at that, like just sitting down and crafting. I always had to be inspired.
Right.
And this is the result of me sitting down and trying to craft a song. I was like, I'm just going to write a song.
Okay. And this was the one.
This is what I wrote.
Nice.
One, two, three, four. There's a white trash chick at the donut shop. Reads her horoscope, calls her old man Pop. Runs a red light, flips off the cop. His name is Bob and lives down the block. Don't sleep, I drink coffee instead. Trying to burn a hole through my aching head. Now I'm thinking about you. Motel 6 out of Louisville, Kentucky. People are large and clearing house lucky. And across the border, a couple old Hoosiers looking kind of lifeless and worn, well-traveled. Two states of the Union, they set out to find the place where Abe Lincoln was born. Don't sleep, I drink coffee instead. Trying to burn a hole through my aching head. Aye, 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 I'm thinking about you. I drove in a New York City, garbage bacon on the street. It was not pretty. I saw coal duster, trash can Pete. They was wasting time on Essex Street. Yeah, they had jacked the hydrants, straight the ladies with the dollar bill earrings and the little black babies. While I don't sleep, only dream. Caffeine hole burning through my spleen. And baby, I'm thinking about you. Junkie with a face like Van Gogh, two eyes, two ears, but only half a nose, and the boys say, beat it, girl, you stink. You got a hair full of lice, a mouth full of drink, and trash can peek is a dumb bitch wink. Well, with me, that shit don't fly, it sink. I don't bother with nothing. Try to protest, I get the hell out of Dodge. I 80 back to the Midwest, I don't sleep, I drink coffee. Thank you. one crazy chord in there, I think.
All right. So, Trash Can...
I haven't played that in a while.
Cold Dust or Trash Can Pee, they real people?
No.
No, okay. Totally made up.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's the thing. Like, I was just writing a song.
Okay.
I was like, I'm going to just... But actually, Cold Duster... wait, what was it? What was it?
I saw Cold Duster, Trash Can Pee.
Yeah, Cold Duster, right. I remember I was driving, where was I? It's so funny because when I think about this song, I'm sure like all the images and everything that people must see when they hear the song, what I see is this Motel 6 hotel room that I was in.
Okay, yeah.
And the table and like... the thing I'm writing on, and I had just driven, and I'm not even sure where I was. I mean, obviously it's those towns, you know, but I was driving by something and there was a big, huge boulder and someone had spray painted Coal Duster.
Look at that.
On it.
Wouldn't you love to have a picture of that boulder right now?
I would.
Right?
I would. And if I had a cell phone that took a picture right. back in 1990.
Oh, back in the day.
I would have, but they didn't have those back then. Tabby, come on, can we talk about the fact that I toured all over this great nation with a map?
Hell yeah.
With a
fucking map, that's right. Now, I was doing it, you know, I was doing it 10 years after you. So I would at least go to, I had the Atlas, but I would go to Kinko's and download the MapQuest. But you did it before MapQuest.
Yeah, before MapQuest.
Right, just with a fucking map, trying to figure out where the damn club was.
Like, and, actually, like, looking at the roads, like, turning it, like, yeah, okay, I'm going this direction. And payphones. And payphones, right?
Yeah.
There were no interviews on the road, or you had to stop at a gas station and get in
call
the payphone,
up.
Put your quarters in. Oh my God!
I remember calling radio stations
That's
collect
hysterical.
At the very beginning of it. I
right?
Call, yeah.
Collect, right.
Yeah.
Collect,
you feel like such
call
a,
from.
Well, I'm at a payphone. Where else can I go? I've got 8 quarters.
So hysterical.
I know. The person I always think about is Robert Crane. You know, Robert Crane that played Colonel Hogan.
Yes.
Okay.
Robert
and he was
Crane.
Yeah.
Like,
and he was way into like not only would he was like a swinger, he'd have a lot of sex because who wouldn't? But he was also into videotaping it. And he had, you know, back in the 60s and 70s, he had all this video equipment.
I did not know that.
Oh, it's famous. It's like
That's
it's his thing, right? And I keep thinking like Robert Crane, he was murdered in 1978.
Oh yeah, I remember that.
In
yeah.
Phoenix or something. And I keep thinking Robert Crane would love to live in a world where everybody has a video camera in their pocket
yeah,
at all times.
Yeah, there you go.
He's like, that's my dream.
Oh my God.
All right.
Crazy.
So
anyway.
without dwelling on Robert Crane. So now you decide to make a record at Gark, like Dark with a G.
Studios.
Okay.
Yeah.
And how does it get heard by an A&R guy?
Okay, so this guy Jonathan Block, who I met and said, yeah, I didn't finish.
I do it all myself.
I don't need a manager. What I have no idea about is how to get a major label deal. And if you can get me a major label deal, you can be my manager. That's the deal I made with him.
That's some shit out of a movie.
Unbelievable. He got me a major label deal.
For better or worse.
He was amazing.
Yeah.
And, you know, if he ever comes across this podcast, I would love him to know that I just love him in my memory because we had kind of a falling out at the end because, you know, it was like there were contract negotiations
they
happening.
They kept your record.
Well, no, not that, but even before that, the label actually not made me. Because they can't make you do anything like that, but they suggested strongly that I fire him.
Oh.
And he was totally behind me 100%. And as a 25-year-old in this new world, I really couldn't.
Why did they want to get rid of him?
See that. Because he was always pushing them and wanting to do things.
Because he had your best interest at heart.
Yeah, because he was really. Really pushing for me. And he made some dumb mistakes. He made a couple stupid, you know, calls. We had like, you know, I mean, that's a whole other interview. I mean, there was a lot.
Part two.
There was a lot going on at Columbia Records, and there's a lot of politics, and I had never been in a corporate environment.
Right.
I had never been in, you know, I'd never been in a situation that complex or that sort of with that amount of money changing hands,
right.
You know? I mean, my record cost, like, I don't know, $200,000 or something, but that was chump change.
Wait, $200,000 to make at
no,
Gart?
No, 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 like all the all-in costs, like all the touring I did.
Oh, right. Okay. Like, oh, you know, so you were now you were major label touring, so you were getting tour support.
Yes, but it was like, you know, we were in a van, you know, where other people were on buses. You know, we were like the very, like, beginning,
right.
You know.
Now, who was booking the shows?
Different people at different times.
Okay,
but like,
through the
we
label?
Had a booking
or?
Agent. No. No, I had a booking agent. And, you know, anyway, so it was a shame that
And what was his name again?
Who, Jonathan Block.
Jonathan Block, okay.
Jonathan Block. Great guy. And he also managed G Love and Special
Oh, Glove, yeah.
And I think maybe still does. I'm not
okay.
sure. But what was my point? He gets me this conversation with David Kahn, who, like, you know, I go to his office and, well, the first time I met with David, he was like, I'm really interested in what you do, but I'm not at a point where I'm ready to sign you, but, like, keep doing what you're doing and I, you know, keep in touch.
Kind so this of was a meeting in New York?
Before I recorded it. I don't sleep.
Okay.
Yes, a meeting in New York.
Okay.
So Jonathan got me this meeting with David.
Okay. And so then, now, so you were you in New York on a tour, or were you?
Yeah.
Okay.
And
so this was at the Columbia offices
Black
in
Rock,
Midtown? Okay.
Black Rock, before they moved to the Sony building.
Okay.
Which was awesome. And every time I go there, I'm just like, yeah, that's part of my history.
Nice.
Really cool. But
do you remember what you wore to the meeting?
Yes.
What do you wear?
I'm so glad there's no photograph.
But you remember.
I wore a dress that I made.
Atta girl.
This sort of like straight dress that like, it was goofy. I don't know. It was the 80s, 90s. I guess it was the 90s by then.
Combat boots? What'd you wear on your feet?
Probably.
Yeah, atta girl.
Probably Doc Martens. Uh-huh. I have no idea. I don't know. Anyway. So then I recorded I Don't Sleep, and Jonathan sent it to David and followed up with him and followed up with everyone, and like it was a little pit bull about it, and David loved it and decided to sign me, and that was it.
Nice.
It was awesome.
So then you're in an office, sign in a deal, like how many, what was it, a two, three?
It's a two record deal.
Okay.
It's complicated, like two firm deal.
Right.
Of course, Columbia has eight, but I have two.
Right, right, yeah.
And then, you know, just basic, you know.
Would you get an advance?
Very small advance. I think it was like $30,000.
Okay.
Something like that. But did a publishing deal.
Oh, nice.
Warner Chappell.
Oh, okay.
Got a lot more money for that.
All right. So you get some checks every now and then?
Every now and then. Not so much now.
Okay.
But for a while it was, you know, I was getting some royalties. But I never really had a breakthrough hit song. So
right.
I never really got that, which is a bummer because
but
that would have been good.
Of the two of us, there's one person at this table that opened up for Robert Zimmerman.
That's right.
We mentioned Bob a lot on this podcast.
Oh, we love Bob Dylan. Yeah, for two shows in Luxembourg and Paris.
No big deal, just Luxembourg and Paris.
And that was all Jonathan Block.
Oh, really?
Yes. He was like, we did this tour in France, and the entire time he was on the phone trying to make the Dylan deal happen.
Okay.
Because I was in France. And and Bob Dylan was in Europe.
Oh, so it was a last minute.
Ish. I mean, it was like a month ahead or
Sweet.
Something like that. But yeah, I was in the running for it for a long time.
What year was
but
this?
But then like he was trying to close this deal. This is 93. 93. And I'm touring by myself. And then so I remember I'm doing an interview in Toulouse, the mm-hmm. pink city. And Jonathan interrupts the interview, which
right.
never happens,
right.
right? And he walks in and he goes, I've got good news and I've got bad news.
All
this
right.
is very him. And he goes, the good news is I got you two opening slots for Dylan in Paris and Luxembourg.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah, what could be bad?
The bad news is no solo artists are allowed to open up for Dylan.
So you got to bring a band. You got to find a band in Europe. All right, how'd that go? What'd
so
you do?
I'm in France. And I'm just like freaking out. And I, well, what I ended up doing was pulling together a band of guys from New York that I'd met, and
you flew them out.
Knew, and flew them out.
Nice.
And we did two rehearsals.
So you took a loss on the shows, you think?
A loss? I don't. You mean like?
Like to pay for to fly guys out and back?
I don't. I never looked at the
money.
Oh,
I'm sorry. You were a rock star back then.
I didn't know anything about that. That's why I have no money now. I was like, whatever, you know, whatever it costs. But that's how major labels work. You know, you get an opportunity, they
right.
fund it.
Oh, okay.
And it goes against your royalties.
Oh, okay. Okay, fair enough.
So it didn't really, you know, all the tours were like that.
All right, so tell me about
so
the
they
Dylan
were
shows.
Funded, but on the back end, you know, it,
yeah.
I had to break through to really see.
Yeah, but you never got, you never... So you never recouped?
No, I never recouped.
So don't you technically owe them a bunch of money, the labels?
Yeah.
They won't come after you, though.
No, they don't. That's part of the deal.
Right.
Like, they don't, you know, you don't really owe them so much as you have a balance sheet with them.
Right.
So if at some point in the future I put out a song, it gets in a movie and it becomes this massive hit, and then my old albums sell, you know, I won't make any money on those until my balance hits zero.
Unless you actually outlast the major label and Sony goes belly up. That's what we can hope for. That's right.
That's hysterical.
If you're in it for the long haul.
Oh, don't worry. There's a lawyer somewhere. They'll make sure they get theirs.
All right. So tell me about the Dylan shows.
Dylan shows were amazing.
Okay.
Amazing. I played at La Cigale in Paris. Mm-hmm. Definitely the highlight of
my like a half
career.
Hour set?
Something like that. And you know, there were no solo acoustic opening acts, but I did stop and play this one song that was really an intense song that I'd been working on, and the band cut out, and I just played that one solo acoustic song.
Okay.
And it was the most, it was like walking on a tightrope. There are 6,000 Dylan fans silently, just like that first time at the Fort.
Yeah.
Watching me and listening to me. And it was like, and I was just, this song was kind of like pouring my heart out. You know, it was a very like difficult kind of thing for me to write. And then I got to meet him afterwards, and
which is a big deal. That doesn't always happen.
Yes. And he said, I really liked that song that you
the solo
sang,
one.
The solo song.
So now, when you yes. get to meet Dylan, does he call for you? Does he send for you?
Oh, or? Yeah. I don't know if he does, but his, you know, his people came to our dressing room, which we were not allowed to leave. And
for fear of making eye contact with.
Yes, exactly. And said, you know, Bob Dylan would like to meet you. And
maybe tomorrow I'm busy.
I know.
I'm
right?
in the middle of a thing.
bring me to him.
Yes.
It was really nice. It was really, really cool.
Okay, so try like is he sitting on a chair? What's...
No. We're all like just, you know, he was standing in this small room behind the stage that
okay.
you know, there were some other people there, and you know, I just came in and shook his hand, and you know, I had no idea what to say. I didn't say anything intelligent. I remember talking about his shirt. I was like, I love that shirt. It's really cool. And then I was like, that's all I came up with.
That's cool. He said he liked your song.
He said he liked my song, and I just, you know, I was like, you know, I was like, I would love to send it to you, and I did later, but I don't know that he ever got it,
yeah.
you know, whatever. But it was just, you know, what was amazing about meeting him and actually seeing him for the first time before even meeting him in Luxembourg. I remember seeing him like kind of walk past our dressing room, and you know, he's a small guy. He's not like a you know, like a towering presence, but he is a towering presence, and his presence is so magical. And I don't know what that is. I guess from being an icon for most of your life, you know, you just kind of have this energy, and maybe he always did, and that's why he became what he became. I really don't know. But when I saw him walk past, I totally got it in a way that I had never gotten it before.
Oh, okay.
Just right. He's the voice of a generation. Like
all right.
He's just, there he is. You know, it was really cool. And then, so meeting him was really cool. It was really amazing.
All right. So let's get to the shitty part of the story.
Okay.
So Epiphany comes out.
Really...
Yeah, I know. Epiphany
no, okay.
comes out. You're You're touring. You go to make your next record. Is that where shit starts to hit the fan?
I think the shit really hit the fan when Alanis Morissette blew up.
Okay. Why is that?
Here's why. Because she became a multi-billion dollar industry staple.
Mm-hmm.
And David Kahn passed on signing her, which made Donny Einar really mad, I think. But David was my main guy,
right,
at the label. And I think he knew that he was not going to be there much longer.
Okay.
And so if he left, I really had nobody. Because not only was he the head of A&R, but he was my A&R guy.
And you had already fired John Block.
Right. And they had already taken me into a room and said, listen, we can't work with him. We won't work with him. So you can keep him as your manager, but we can't work with him. That's what they told me.
Oh, that's harsh.
That stinks.
You were, what, 25, 24-year-old girl?
Yeah, 25.
Yeah.
And, yeah, what do I know?
Right.
You know, I don't know anything about politics. I don't know anything about, you know.
It's not like I'm a poli-sci major or anything.
Not that kind of politics. I could tell you about the Russian Revolution.
If I was down there with the Romanovs.
Walk in China.
Listen, but, it's Rasputin's fault.
But what I could not tell you is is that you don't go into a meeting with Don Einar and say, like, yeah, that tour was really messed up.
Oh, yeah.
That came back to, you know, stuff like that. Yeah. I made all kinds of those kinds of kid mistakes, you know? Like, I didn't really know about corporate. That's a whole different deal. But, my God, like, I wouldn't trade those experiences for anything.
That right.
was amazing. So,
he got fired.
Yes. So he was fired, super mad at me for good reason. And
no,
then,
no, John Block was mad at you.
Oh, and then, yeah. Oh, you didn't mean John. You meant David Kahn.
David Kahn.
David Kahn didn't get fired while I was signed there, but I think there was a lot of delays on my album. I think he was at odds. You know, that's in my mind what the story is. I'm sure there was more to the story
okay.
than that. But somewhere in there was some disconnect between the higher ups, and then David eventually left. But I think he basically said to me, listen, there's, you know, all these changes going on, and I probably can get them to release your album, but I don't think it's going to get supported. I don't really, you know what you want to do. Probably
you had recorded it already.
All recorded. Remixed Yellow Sun 12 times, spent $30,000 remixing that song because it was going to be this huge hit.
Right.
Like, it was really bad, actually, for me. It was a bad, bad day.
Because that's where we met, because you were playing at Galifty's in Harrisburg, of all places.
Really?
Yes. And
that's where we met the first time?
That's the first time we ever met, because here's my little part of the story is that Howard and I drove out to Harrisburg. Because we're like, oh my God, she's so close, she's in Harrisburg. Not knowing that, like, you're living in New York again, and we could just go
see
you any night, right?
I was in Minneapolis.
But we drove out to see this, you know, and we end up at this Galifty's, this pizza place or whatever, with a little stage. It was a pretty nice place.
I don't remember it.
Oh, this is a big deal for me. No, of course not. It's just another gig for you. And then and we go there, and we're looking around the bar, and there's one little 5-foot-nothing-inch girl with all this dark hair, and we're like, oh my God, I think that's her.
Oh my God.
And we walk up, and we said hi. And try not to be too creepy.
I remember meeting you guys, but I'm not seeing the space in my mind.
Yeah, it was in the basement. It might have been it might have been underneath this Galifty's or something in Harrisburg.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So yeah, and then you were talking about you confided in us about how either it was the sound guy or the manager, like, touched your back, and that creeped you out.
Really?
Yeah. And you're like, I don't like that. And it was like, note to self: don't touch her back.
Ah, I'm very energy. Like, I can feel people's energy really clearly. So, like, when it depends, you know, like, somebody will put their hand on my shoulder and nothing. Somebody else will, and I'll be like, okay.
Thomas was there. Yes, because you guys were on a tour and you were out for 2 weeks. It was like the middle of friggin' winter.
You got to experience that tour.
One
okay,
night of
now
it.
Now
yeah.
I know.
Okay. You know, remember the tour?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, was it tough?
Oh, yes. It was hysterical. Actually, it was an awesome time for both of us. And I was so glad he was with me, because Thomas, who is my husband now.
Yes.
At the time, we had really not been together for very long. Excuse me. We met, I think, in 93.
Okay.
And maybe even, yeah, I think 93. And then, you know, he was like, yeah, touring is like, you know, what do? You just drive around and show up and and play songs, like big deal. So I'm like, you know what, pot shot, like, why don't you come on tour with me and you can be my tour manager. And he was like, all right, that's cool. Okay, here's someone I wouldn't pick as a tour manager, Thomas. Okay. But that's another story. And so he comes, he's in Chinese medicine school at the time.
Right.
He has, I'm going to say, a stack of books this high of Chinese medicine books that he's going to get some studying done on the road. And I'm like, seriously, dude? Like, we're going to be a little bit busy. You know, I know there's some driving to do, but whatever. So he's my tour manager. So the second day, we're driving. I have an interview with the Columbus radio station, and we're driving across the Columbus border, and the interview's at like 1 or something, and neither of us think about the time change.
Oh. you're a road dog. You should know this.
No. Yeah, well, you know what? You know, I didn't think of it. And so, and he didn't think of it. Mm-mm. And it was his job because he's the tour manager. And I ended up doing the interview from a payphone mm-hmm. at a gas station because there was no way we were going to make it to Columbus. Right. And after that, he kind of shaped up a little bit.
Understood.
He was like, oh, you have to pay attention to the details. And there's just a lot of little details. I mean,
yeah.
It's not rocket science, but it's this other thing, you know. And we also had a quest, which was helpful, which was to find an old antique typewriter, which we ended up at the very end finding in this antique, like, barn.
Okay.
And was later the Remington typewriter of Remington fame on my last album.
Oh, nice. Very nice. Oh, cool. Because I remember I gave you my little cassette, my little Deeply Flawed, my first cassette. And you don't have to remember this, but
right.
But we both had AOL accounts at the time.
Oh, yeah.
And so with AOL back in the day, you could send someone an email and see if they had read it yet.
Right.
And like, so every day, Howard and I would check to see if you had read our email. And eventually, like, right at the end of the tour, I got like a 2-sentence email from you. We finally listened to that tape, on that crazy tape of yours on the way back, and loved it. You said something vaguely positive about
it. Oh, that's cool.
And I danced around my living room.
This is your music?
My music, yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
okay,
Deeply Flawed,
right.
Yeah.
Oh, and Deeply Flawed. Right,
it was the name of my first cassette.
Right,
yeah.
No, right.
Yeah.
I thought you were... Never mind.
No,
got
it's
it.
Okay. That's why I named it that. Yeah.
Deeply Flawed. Well, tell me about it. I listened to some of the first... Like, it's funny.
Yes. So that's... So then you... But right around then, you had... They kept... Sony kept your sound recordings, right? Do they still have them?
They did, but then Shaunakee released that album.
Oh, that's... I forgot about Charlie over at Shaunakee.
That's right. And
what was his last name?
DeHaan.
Charlie DeHaan, yeah.
And then they released it, which was awesome. They didn't do a lot to promote it, and it was kind of one of these, I thought that came out, but then I couldn't find it. And then, you know, oh, but then it did, but then nobody knew. But...
Because Shaunakee put out Latch's Anti-Hoot record too, right?
Yeah, I think so. And then, but...
Which you were on. Remember you played the Grout song?
Is Grout on that?
Yes, Grout's on that record.
Hysterical.
Yes.
Which was also Winchester Chimes' song. That was for Winchester.
Oh, okay. All right.
We pulled an all-nighter once and ended up at this diner in the East Village, and we were playing that game that where you had to say like four-letter word. The game was to say a four-letter word. And you had to guess what the game was. So you'd go, that game for this. You just had to only use four-letter words.
Okay. Oh, okay.
But grout's a five-letter word. I don't
know. No, it is,
happened,
yeah.
But we were right. Laughing about the grout. Anyway, okay, so Where were we? Sorry.
Oh,
geez. A-Dog. What's going on?
Yeah, the sound recordings with Charlie put out, Shonky put out, right.
Okay, so they have a sister company with Koch in Germany. Send it to Koch. Koch loves it.
Okay.
There's a guy, there's always a person in my career, which was so awesome, who just kind of got it, you know?
Okay.
And in this case, it was this guy, Yogi, if it was the name he went by. But he's this German guy, sent it out to all the press saying, you got to hear this. And this is outside the beauty salon.
Oh, yeah, right.
And it just went through the roof. Like, I got like all kinds of reviews, all kinds of press. And I ended up touring in Germany behind that album, and it did really well.
Right, because that's when your manager yelled at me.
Right. So I had, you know, like other successes throughout, and then we put out, what's it called, Hunger?
Yes.
Which was kind of a Jeff Buckley, you know, like kind of, what's the word?
Homage, tribute?
Homage, yeah, tribute, right.
So. You were, now you said, I thought you were friends with Buckley, but you just met him a couple of times, right? You didn't meet him?
We were close
friends. Oh, you were close friends, okay. Because... Mm-hmm. The very first time I played the Tin Angel,
uh-huh.
room in Philadelphia, it was because it was a show that I had set up.
Oh, okay.
With you headlining. And
right.
The reason it was October 5th, 1997. The only reason I remember that date,
wow.
I remember that date is because it's exactly 30 years after Woody Guthrie died. He died on October 5th, 67.
Right.
So we played that show. It was you and me, and there might have been a third. And it was a big deal for me to play the Tin Angel. It was the first time I ever played it.
Yeah.
And it was a big deal to open for Brenda Khan. This was all very cool stuff. And I think I picked you up at the train.
Wasn't it Ed Hamill on that? Or that was a different show?
No, it was a different show, yeah. Because I don't think Hamill would have needed... That three would have been... I wouldn't have been... I would have had no place on that bill at the time.
Right.
So, but I picked you up at the train, and it was when they had discovered Buckley's body.
In October?
So
I got married... No, because I got married in August.
Okay.
And he was supposed to come to the wedding, and then he died like a few months before that.
Okay.
I think it was May.
All right.
Or, yeah.
Well, whatever the hell the story is, you know what? Maybe it was this. Anyway. The dates aren't working out. But we were at the diner.
But it was
97. And you were no longer a vegetarian because your doctor told you you were anemic.
Yeah,
you were eating
that's
corned
right.
beef, which I found. I always find it hilarious when vegetarians fall off the wagon.
That's right.
And
I remember that.
And I was making Jeff Buckley jokes.
Right.
And you were like, you know, he's kind of a close personal friend of mine. I was like, oh, well, that makes this awkward.
Yeah, I remember that. I think about him a lot. You know, I was just like he'll come into my mind and I'll think like, God, if he were alive, like, would he have a kid and would we just be like texting like, yeah, the dog just puked on the carpet, you know, like, or whatever. Like, he was such a, you know, sort of bright light.
So you guys met at the label?
Yes. We met at David Kahn's office.
Okay.
And I went home and had a dream about him. I dreamed that he was making me shiitake mushrooms. And shiitakes are like supposed to be really good for you. You know, it was like sort of this really healing kind of thing. And I woke up and I called him and I told him, I just had this dream. You were making me shiitake mushrooms. And then we started hanging out.
All right.
Isn't that weird?
No, that's not weird.
And funny?
It doesn't take Sigmund Freud to figure that one out.
The shiitake mushroom.
Yeah.
Obvious.
Right.
Duh. We wrote one amazing song together.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Do you know it? Do you want to play it?
I can't play it.
Okay.
And sing it. He played it.
Okay.
And I sang it. It's a really cool song. You should check it out.
What's it called?
It's called, I'm thinking Outside the Beauty Salon for some reason. I'm thinking of this other song and it's making it hard for me to remember. God, they both start kind of the same way. In the Faith Salons.
Faith Salons. I didn't realize that was him as well.
Yeah, he's playing on that and singing background vocals on that.
I knew he sang, now that I think about it, I knew he sang the background vocals, yeah.
Yeah, they're haunting.
Why don't you sing us one more song, because you have an important phone call coming up.
Unfortunately. Something. I do have another new song.
It's all you, baby. Whatever you want.
It's kind of a quiet-ish song.
That's what you want?
Or I could do something off of the last album.
No,
you tell me. No, you.
I want you to play the rocking ear one.
Neither of them are super rocky.
I want you to play the one that you're prouder of. I don't know either of these songs, so I can't say.
Yeah, I'm just thinking. Let's see. I was thinking there's something more rockin' that I could play. Nah, all right, I'm just going to go for the full-on not rockin'.
This is part one. We still have the whole second half of your life to deal with. You're only like 30 at the end of this story. So I'm going to come back in a few months, and we'll talk about how you got this beautiful house.
I know, we didn't even talk about, like... You know.
We didn't even talk about how the label bought you this Martin D41 with all the things made entirely out of abalone. When I first saw this guitar, I was like, Jesus Christ, that's flashy.
This is pretty good, although I've trashed it, haven't I?
You're supposed to. It's a beautiful guitar. And you have that, do you still have is the case still have the wheels on it?
Oh, yeah.
You went to, I thought it was, I looked all around for a case like that because I thought it was so cool, but you went to the luggage store. Were they Hasidic Jews or did I just make that part up?
You made that up.
Okay. Let's say they were Hasidic Jews. And you went in, and it was Friday at like 3:30.
I was like, I've got to have wheels. I've got an airport.
But it's Shabbos. I need it. They did it quick for you because they saw your nose.
Oh, my God. What are you trying to say?
I'm trying to say.
All right. This is a new song. And what's it called? Don't know. We'll work it out.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Some Other Lovers.
Nice.
So what if I was wrong? So what if you were right? So what if it was easy for me to walk away from love? But if you hold me now, drift away, let some other lovers save the world today. They say it's gonna rain, but it is gonna pour. Half my life for you. What are you waiting for? But if you hold me now, it all might drift away. Let some other lovers save the world today.
Still got it, BK. That's very nice. I like that a lot.
We're working on it.
So, here, can I borrow the expensive?
Absolutely.
So, it has been truly my pleasure to chat with Ms. Brenda Khan. No, my name ain't baby. It's Brenda, Ms. Khan, if you're nasty. Up in her lovely home in the wilderness of the Lehigh Valley.
Center Valley.
So we're an hour away from each other. We should hang out more. Now that we go out, we can meet as couples now. Like, that's what married people do. They
that's
go out as couples, right?
Right?
They go to
right.
respectable BYOBs and shit like that.
Yeah, except for if you have kids, you go to
Oh, yeah, you're ahead of us in that
that's
regard, right?
Yeah.
So we can meet at Chuck E. Cheese in the ball pit.
Okay, not that
not
bad.
That. Somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, somewhere in the middle.
Anyway, so it has been my genuine pleasure. Here's what I can do. There's a white trash chick at the donut shop. Reads her horoscope, calls her old man pop. Runs a red light and flips. I do it much worse than you because I don't even know all this nasty stuff.
Oh,
up
yeah,
here, but,
you gotta get the little fancy finger work.
I learned it before I
know. When are we gonna do something together?
I know, right? We haven't played together probably since the first time in the 90s.
I mean, come on.
But you came to the X Fest a couple years ago. That was awesome.
Yeah.
You came and played the X Fest. That was cool. Yeah, we should do a thing. We should do a thing.
Yeah, no, I meant sing together. Yeah.
We should totally sing together.
Yeah.
That would be awesome. We're going to work all that out.
All right.
Now that because you're a good friend. It's fun hanging out with you, and it's fun hearing your stories. I'm going to have you back on, and we'll talk about part two.
All right.
This has been great. Brenda Kahn, Goldfish Don't Talk Back on Community 3 if you find it. And she said you can email her at what's your website? BrendaKahn.com?
It is BrendaKahn.com. I'm in the middle of kind of changing it.
Not Woman Rock anymore?
No.
Okay, that was a good idea, though.
And that's a whole other part of
the
story.
Yeah, the Woman Rock. She was
my gosh.
The champion of bitches everywhere, although I don't think she puts it that way.
And Seven Laws of Gravity is on iTunes.
Seven Laws of Gravity on iTunes. Epiphany in Brooklyn is that
it's still on iTunes also.
It's on iTunes also. Mm-hmm. Epiphany in Brooklyn, Seven Laws of Gravity, and then Outside the Beauty Salon. Is that?
Yeah, I don't. That also came out on Shaunikey. I'm not sure how accessible.
Here's what you do.
The other two are.
Get the stuff on iTunes that Brenda has, and then when you fall in love with Brenda Kahn's songwriting, you contact Brenda Kahn at BrendaKahn.com, and she will hook you up with the rest. She will call you up
personally
at a pre-described time and sing to you any song you want while you're in the car.
There you go.
So, because she has lots of copious free time. Anyway,
right.
It has been a blast hanging out with Brenda Kahn. We're going to sing our theme song and get the fuck out of here. I'll put the thing on right. So, thanks for listening. Who Rhymes Against Humanity with Adam Brodsky, Deconstructing Songs and Songwriting. Excellent, we are clear.
Awesome.